From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we have a firsthand account of what it's like to be a COVID-19 survivor in Milwaukee. Then, astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins us to talk about a new black hole discovery.
So every time you find a black hole is a victory, and the fact that it's close enough that you can see the accompanying star together is definitely unique. In most cases, you haven't any chance of doing that.
Plus, we learn how Near West Side Partners are working with businesses in their neighborhoods as they look to the future.
They're in uncharted territory, and they're trying to just figure out what makes sense as far as for the safety and the wellness of their employees and other patrons, but also what makes sense for as far as the future and reopening.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the U.S. has over 1 million total cases of COVID-19. In Wisconsin, the cumulative number of cases is now over 12,000. A global pandemic and numbers like these can be a little hard to grasp until coronavirus affects you or someone you know directly. For us here at WUWM, our former staff member Danielle Nelson was that someone. Danielle is a healthy 37-year-old woman with no pre-existing conditions who was seemingly at a low risk for contracting coronavirus. However, what started as chest pains she initially dismissed escalated to getting hospitalized with COVID-19. She joins me now to share her story in the hope that others can connect with it and learn from her experience. Danielle begins by explaining when she initially started feeling unwell.
Yeah, so I started having chest pain around probably March 12th or 13th. And I didn't really think too much of it because these are crazy times we're living in. And I thought it was just anxiety. And so I kind of shrugged it off. But then on March 16th, I started feeling a little off in the morning. And then by the evening, I had a kind of a full-on fever. And so I pretty much did not leave my bed for the next several days until the afternoon of March 19th, when I ended up going to the ER to get tested. It was a really brief visit. They gave me a prescription for albuterol to help with breathing, which at the time I didn't need. So I went home, went immediately back to bed, and then really it kind of took a turn for the worse. And so it got to the point where, it was really hard to walk. I was resisting the urge to crawl, to get around the house. So in the later afternoon of March 24th, I ended up going back to the ER and then was there until the 29th and then was back home and have been recovering from home since March 29th.
So before you went to the ER that first time to get tested, were you on the phone with a doctor and the recommendation was to go and get tested? Was it a difficult thing to get testing? Because that is kind of an inconsistent thing right now throughout the country is testing availability.
Yeah, I think maybe for the area, I was maybe ahead of the curve. So, there was no wait in the emergency room. I was in and out in 15 minutes. And I didn't call anyone ahead of time. I just had a feeling. And my fever was kind of all over the place while I was in bed from, it would be 99 and then it spiked at 104. So I knew that I just really was not well and I shouldn't have a fever for that many days in a row. So I just went to the ER.
Right. And you are, a young, healthy person, no pre-existing conditions, no history of smoking, nothing like that. It was unexpected, right?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, when I look at the list of, folks or conditions that might put me more at risk, I don't meet any of them. And so it was another reason I kind of looked past the chest pain initially, just because I thought, I shouldn't really be at risk. So maybe I could worry a little bit less, but that was obviously my mistake.
Well, and there's a lot of information being bombarded at us. So by the time you're admitted into the hospital, and this was before any tests came back positive or negative, correct?
Right.
So what was your experience like to be a COVID patient inside the hospital?
Being in the hospital with COVID was really scary and really isolating because, as you probably know, no one's allowed into the hospital. And so I was there by myself. And, you know, I've been messaging with someone on Facebook who is in the hospital now with COVID in a different part of the country. And she kind of compared it to being a zoo animal. and when I read that, I choked up because that was really my experience as well. You know, understandably, doctors and nurses are afraid. And I felt that very much so. And just having that limited contact was really scary when you're, you know, spending so much time alone with your thoughts.
So no visitors outside of medical staff coming in to check on you. You're isolated. Medical staff are covered head to toe in PPE. You know, were there certain things they tried to do to help you feel more comfortable and less intimidated? Or is everyone just as overwhelmed by everything?
Well, I think, again, I think because it seems like I was there kind of on the front end of people getting COVID here, there was a lot still being sorted out. And I think folks hadn't quite adjusted to the new normal. And so everyone was so nice to me, of course, and very professional. But, you know, just being another human being, I can pick up on people's anxiety. And it's scary and hard to be the diseased one that everyone's afraid of. when I'm afraid of myself as well.
Yeah. So how were you feeling, you know, levels of pain and stress physically feeling during the days you're at the hospital? I understand you didn't need a ventilator. You were having some difficulties coughing and those kind of symptoms, but you didn't need to be intubated, fortunately.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really grateful for that. I did receive oxygen and, you know, I think the thing I'm learning about COVID is that there's really a lot of ups and downs. And that was true for me in the hospital as well. I'd have, you know, times where I just, you know, I couldn't even make it to the bathroom by myself without calling someone in to help me. And I really wasn't able to eat. And, you know, and then, you know, of course, being in a hospital, it's hard to sleep anyway. But, you know, having difficulties sleeping. But then, of course, there were moments that were a little bit easier. And certainly, you know, by the end, I felt like, you know, I was ready to go home, even though I wasn't even sure I was ready to go home. I was scared to go home. And even now, being at home, there's good days and bad days still.
Were there any misconceptions about the disease that you had that made you maybe waiting for certain things to happen to you or feel while you were in the hospital because you heard of other people going through it and it was kind of in those initial stages?
Yeah, well, because, you know, it started out just as some chest pain and then it was kind of just a fever and then it was a sore throat. You know, I kept worrying that it was going to get worse and worse and that I would end up on a ventilator. And so, because so many people do, and you hear about the shortages of ventilators. And so, I'm really just so grateful that, I ended up not having to get to that point, but definitely those thoughts were the ones that were keeping me up at night.
Yeah. And, in your first Facebook post that you shared, sharing your story and that you were positive, you wrote about a moment that you prepared to say your goodbyes to your fiance and your mom. And I mean, I can't imagine that, but how was it to feel the need to do that, to feel like this might be the lowest point, this might be the end in a life that people assume has so much more to go?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's hard to go back to that moment because, I just love life and I feel like there's so much more that I want to do. And I think reflecting back now, it gives me a lot more empathy for other people who are in those moments, because it's sad and it's scary, especially being there alone and not being able to really touch anyone and touch the people I love and tell them in person that I love them. You know, I kept getting worse and I kept thinking, this, I can only get worse for so long. And I was, you know, hooked up to heart monitors. And when I went into the hospital, I was really dehydrated and had super low blood pressure. And so it's not that I wasn't hopeful that I would get better, but my body wasn't getting better and it was causing me to worry.
Did you have that same amount of worry when you first had to go back to the ER to be admitted? Did you think this could be the last time I see this person?
No, I didn't at that moment because honestly, I was so out of it. You know, I couldn't even get myself out of the car. I was put into a wheelchair and then it's almost like I hardly remember even that those first, you know, that first night in the hospital. So I was so out of it. I wasn't even really thinking about anything. I was mostly sleeping.
In the moments when you were awake and thinking and concerned and noticing how your body was feeling, in what ways did you try to cope with the pain? Did you find activities or thoughts or things that kind of helped you?
So I had a meditation app that I used, and that helped a little bit just to really help me focus on breathing and not panicking. I completely stopped listening to the news and went off social media and really tried to not look at anything about COVID-19 just because there's so much bad news and it would just cause more anxiety. And then I watched the movie Julie and Julia about 4 or 5 times when I was in the hospital because I was hoping it would spark a desire to eat. Because that was a big issue, is I just did not have an appetite and I only wanted to eat sugary things. And, you know, it didn't work, but it's a great movie. And now I know all the lines.
Yeah, it'll be a movie forever changed for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you able to FaceTime with your family, friends? Did you have the energy to?
No, and I did a little bit. But again, I was so out of it, you know, most of the time and, you know, just kind of dealing with my own demons, it was hard. And I know that, you know, I wasn't looking very good. And, you know, just in that I looked really sick and weak and, you know, I didn't want to scare my friends and family any more than they already were. So I, you know, mostly texting.
So what was the turning point where the doctors were telling you like, okay, it looks like you can be discharged pretty soon?
Yeah. So I got several chest x-rays when I was there because of course I had the pneumonia in my lungs. And the last morning they did a final chest x-ray and it wasn't 100%, but it was well enough where they thought, you know, maybe I'm over the hump. And so they sent me home with some breathing exercises and, you know, with not necessarily medication besides some cough medicine, but, you know, just the doctor's orders to take it easy and stay hydrated.
So you've been out of the hospital and are now technically cleared of that isolation period post-hospital. You know, you can leave your home, but how has your body felt since being released?
So just now I'm starting to feel a little bit back to normal, you know, in my body. I'm still tired. I still take a nap every day, which I had never done before. And now it kind of there's a still lingering feeling in my chest. And I kind of compare it to like going to a bonfire and maybe inhaling too much smoke and feeling it the next day, that kind of crackly, achy feeling in your chest. That's kind of how it feels. And some days are better than others.
So what concerns you the most being a survivor of COVID-19, but not really having any concrete answers?
I'm terrified of infecting someone else. You know, the thing that has been the most frustrating about having COVID is just how nobody knows anything. And people you expect to have the answers, like doctors, like health, public health officials, there's so much that they don't know. And so, you know, I've been cleared. They say that I'm not contagious, but now that I have a little bit of doubt in my mind, and I'm, you know, just mentally a little bit anxious about that risk, because of course the last thing I want to do is hurt anyone.
Why did you decide to share your story first initially online through your Facebook and now with us?
Yeah, well, so I wrote this Facebook post, and originally, you know, I had just written it to friends, and then, you know, my mom asked if she could share it on her Facebook page. So, you know, you do what your mom wants. So I made it public, and all of a sudden, you know, it just kind of blew up, and I think it's been shared like over 30,000 times now. And it's kind of shocking. But when I wrote it, you know, I had just gotten home, and, or, you know, that week, and I still was feeling so horrible. I was sleeping most of the day, and I felt so lonely. And, you know, I didn't really know anyone else who had the same kind of symptoms, or who had had it quite as bad as I had gotten it, or who had been in the hospital. And so, you know, I think thinking about it now, I wanted to tell all my friends that this happened to me. But also I wanted to share my story because I wanted others to know that they weren't alone, that there was someone out there who had had, you know, a similar experience. And I kind of wanted to put myself out there. And that actually since has really helped, I think, in my recovery, helped me feel less alone, less isolated, which is, you know, why I made a website so that people could kind of gather there. And I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks responding to messages through Messenger, through the blog, just with people who are in the hospital, who are at home recovering and just feeling scared. And I feel scared too.
Have they been asking you any common questions that, you know, we haven't already touched upon in our conversation? Because I'm, like you said, there's so much unknown. And even as you are recovering and released, you don't know if you're immune. You don't know what life is going to look like going forward necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people ask about the medications I received in the hospital. People are asking about, in general, how I'm doing. I think it helps people to know that there are people who get COVID who go to the hospital and recover and survive. And so, you know, people just generally checking in on me. And then, you know, just kind of getting a sense of my timeline and when they can expect to feel better. And from my own kind of messaging with people, a lot of folks are saying, you know, it's about taking them about 7 weeks to really feel like themselves again. And I'm not there yet, but I plan to have a little party by myself here in my house when that moment comes.
Well, and your story is helping others, but I think what you've seen, what a lot of people are seeing, is that it affects everyone differently. How important is that point to hit home, that this is your version, you know, of COVID? It might not be exactly the same.
Oh, for sure. I mean, everybody's different, but there are some things that there seem to be trends in my little corner of the world with the folks I've talked with, and, you know, small things like not being able to taste anything, to just kind of a shared understanding of this kind of ongoing feeling in your chest several weeks later, and just kind of the lingering anxiety that, you know, nobody wants to hurt anybody, and just having so many people be so afraid of us and whether we're contagious or not.
Yeah. How are you trying to take care of yourself now and post-recovery?
Yeah, everyone tells me I need to keep drinking water, so I'm trying to do that and stay hydrated. I'm a little bit tired of hearing that, actually. And, you know, I like to walk my dogs around the block, you know, just that kind of basic recentering stuff that I think can help everyone. But, you know, so many people have reached out to me with such kind things to say and kind of hopes for my recovery. And that has helped me. And, you know, I had someone, kind of an acquaintance friend from my alma mater, McAllister College, reach out to me, and who's an art therapist. And so I've been doing some art therapy sessions over video, and that has been really helpful just to kind of regroup after just feeling like I'm on another planet for the last 6 weeks or whatever.
So what's your call to action for everyone listening now and moving forward as many places across the US and around the world continue with extensions for safer at home orders?
I've thought a lot about this, and you know, this is why I called my website Better by Each Other, because I think this whole situation with COVID has made me realize how connected we are and how much we can impact each other. And how we can just do a little bit better by each other. And so maybe that's, you know, wearing a mask, even though it's uncomfortable and it's not perfect, or maybe that's, you know, wearing gloves, or not going to the grocery store today and just eating that macaroni that you have in your pantry instead. Those little things, they have a ripple effect. And I think the more we can do better by each other, the better off we're going to be during this pandemic and the stronger communities we're going to have.
Since you've been home and having this experience, do you think that people aren't taking it as seriously as it should be warranted? Because they maybe don't have the connection, they don't know someone who's had it, and all they're seeing is the news of the worst of it in New York or other things, and it's numbers, it's not connection.
Yeah, I think with anything, hearing personal stories helps people understand things in a new way, which, you know, from that Facebook post that I had, I've been contacted by a lot of different news organizations to do an interview, and I haven't really wanted to, just because I don't necessarily want to be the face of COVID in Wisconsin. But, you know, I chose to do this one because I'm a public radio nerd, and also because I think it is important for people to hear that someone actually has experienced COVID right down the street from them in Stallus. And I think, you know, that stories are what connect people to each other, and I think make it more real for people. And, you know, a little bit, I'm hoping that's what my kind of opening up about my experience will do.
You mentioned Better by Each Other, which is the name of your website and how people have been reaching you. So with that regard, going through these messages you're receiving, how far do they extend? And what have been some of the most impactful or memorable things that have stuck out to you?
You know, the thing that amazes me is how this Facebook post and the website are just getting out to people kind of all over the world. And it's kind of amazing how we're having, in some ways, this very shared experience. And while, you know, everybody's different, there are some similar kind of trends in the people who are messaging me about their recovery, about their fears, about their anxieties. So I've been trying to kind of take what I hear and put these in blog posts just as a way for people who are recovering from home or who are in the hospital can just go there and know that other people have had some of their experiences, and to know that they're not alone in this crazy experience that they're having.
Well, Danielle Nelson, I'm sure all these people in Tenfold are very grateful for you sharing your experience and continuing to help others through it, recovery and beyond. And I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It means a lot.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone who's reached out to me and has really helped with my recovery as well.
Danielle Nelson is a COVID-19 survivor who lives in West Dallas. You can find out more and a link to her website, Better by Each Other, at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we have a conversation with our astronomy contributor, Gene Creighton, about the latest black hole discovery. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. While 1,000 light years may seem like a vast distance away from Earth, in the scale of our universe, it's practically in our backyard. And it's just 1,000 light years away, where astronomers in Chile have found potentially the closest black hole to the Earth. The stellar black hole was discovered by the way it interacts with two stars nearby, and it's unique in that it can be potentially seen with the naked eye, if you live in the southern hemisphere, that is. Our astronomy contributor Gene Creighton notes that the previous black hole thought to be closest to Earth was 3 times farther away, making this discovery a significant find in how we understand the making of black holes. She joins me now to discuss what astronomers know about black holes so far and how the coronavirus has impacted astronomical research. She starts by explaining how the black hole discovery in the Chile Observatory was made.
So how we figured out that this black hole exists is because we watched a star move around what seemed to be empty space, and eventually people could really follow the orbit closely and use, you know, basically Newtonian physics to say what mass would be required to make that star do that. And when they calculated, because it's also a matter of how fast it's going around it, given how fast that star was moving around this unseen companion, they calculated that the mass was so high it had to be a black hole, given the volume that it had to be in. So that's cool. As you say, 1,000 light years feels a long way, but the nearest one was 3 times farther than that. So to give you some kind of sense, we are able to see bright stars at 1,000 light years. So that would be something like Rigel and Orion or Betelgeuse would be that kind of distance. And those stars are super bright. Now, admittedly, they are super luminous, super giants. Most stars at that distance would not be as bright as all that. Every time we find more black holes, we fill out a spectrum of masses. Now, this is what we call a stellar black hole, as opposed to a galactic black hole, what we would find in the center of our galaxy, a supermassive black hole. And we used to think that it's stellar and supermassive galactic black holes, and there really wasn't a whole lot in between. This is definitely a stellar one, but the more data we collect, the better our statistics are to analyze what is the distribution of black holes, not to mention how they might form. So every time you find a black hole is a victory, and the fact that it's close enough that you can see the accompanying star together is definitely unique. In most cases, you haven't any chance of doing that.
From what I understand of the basics, usually a black hole interacts a bit violently with its environment. And this one they just discovered has, you know, kind of 2 stars rotating around it. So just to remind us, can you explain the basics of what a black hole is and how they coexist with all of these other components of the universe?
Sure. So a black hole is an object that has what we call a escape velocity equal to the speed of light, which means that the speed you have to give it for it to leave, for any object to leave the black hole and never come back, is the speed of light. And that means that even light cannot escape a black hole. So that is fairly abstract, what I just described. What we call the event horizon for the black hole, which is kind of what defines its border, if you will, is the moment where that happens, where the escape velocity becomes equal to the speed of light. And it's useful to kind of think about this a little bit, why escape velocity has anything to do with it. Escape velocity depends on how much mass you're trying to escape from and how far you are from the center of that body. So the concept of a black hole is old. It's from the 15th century. A monk was thinking, Mitchell, his name is, was thinking, if you're telling me that the escape velocity depends on the mass I'm trying to escape from and the distance I have from the center, that means that if I take the same amount of mass and squeeze it to a really small volume, that thereby reducing the distance to the center, that means eventually I could make something that's so incredibly dense that it would in fact have an escape velocity of the speed of light. And it took centuries from us to go from a theoretical concept to an actual observation of black holes. But it's one of those beauties of the human mind, right? We can envision things long before we can see them, long before we can measure them. And now we've seen black holes in a variety of different ways.
And this recent discovery, as you mentioned, can be seen in the Southern Hemisphere. And the impact of COVID-19 around the world, of course, is different compared to what we are specifically experiencing in the U.S. But I'm curious how COVID-19 has impacted the work of astronomers. Can you work remotely when many times I think of these massive telescopes that are used and machines, and not a lot of people can do that kind of work from home per se. So what do you know of how work is being impacted currently?
Actually, the distinction would not be mostly for large telescopes, because now most large telescopes are operated remotely, or at the very least, you as the observer do not go to the site, because people have understood that the cost is in some cases prohibitive to have all these hundreds of people show up at telescopes night after night. So they probably have, well, they do have, even now, I'm sure, you know, skeleton crews who operate the telescope, and the positions have been already determined exactly what filters you're going to use, all the parameters that you would need to make those observations. And the person who really knows what they're doing with this telescope is the person who collects the data. So those are not the astronomers who are probably suffering the most. So it wouldn't be observers, because they can get their data, and every observer on the planet has data that's sitting on a computer somewhere that they think, okay, this is it. This is it. I have to analyze this data right now. So they have, you know, side projects. The people who rely heavily on computers, and many people do, or require fancy simulations, again, supercomputers, most of those jobs can be done remotely as well. The people who probably are suffering are the people who their job is to design an instrument that requires a lab. I suspect that those people are the ones who are, you know, really suffering. I was reading about a project in Italy that this is an experiment to measure the nature of dark matter. That is the stuff that makes itself felt, kind of like a black hole. We can see things respond to it, but all this dark matter, and it's a lot, it's like 80% of the mass of our galaxy, is unseen, does not make light to us. So this is a really embarrassing and important question right now in modern astronomy. And the instrument was launched in Italy, which, of course, as you know, as COVID has really impacted them greatly. And they went through all this rigmarole to try at very least get the instrument and the facility at a place where they could stop it. But they basically had to call in people, even when there was, you know, in the process of shutting down the country, to just get everything situated so that a huge investment wasn't just gonna, you know, there's certain things that you really have to do in a lab. You can't just say, oh, I've got 5 tons of xenon. Oh, well, I guess I'm going on vacation. You really have to make sure that everything is situated. I'm thrilled to tell you that despite COVID, it seems like all the work that's been going on with the Perseverance rover that's going to Mars in July, I'm sure we'll talk about that later in the year, seems to be going on, seems to be under, they're still on target. So that's thrilling that hasn't slowed them down, because I was worried about how they would respond to something like this. Then, of course, you remember that all these teams work in clean rooms already. So they probably have, you know, big time protocols that they probably can add a little thing to make sure that they're not working too close to each other.
And how about yourself? Obviously, we're both doing this from our homes. How is your work in astronomy at UWM being impacted, and how have you adapted?
Well, as you know, I do a lot of live programming to the public and to schools. So it's been very strange for me for mid-May to come in and not to have 12 programs a week, which is sort of typical for me this time of year, which means that in some ways I have reserves to do things like projects that I simply haven't been able to do. But it also makes me think, okay, planning with this uncertainty, when are we going to be able to have real, you know, live programs again in the planetarium? What else can we do that would be interesting and good? So I've already started a program that's live for families with kids, and that's been really fun, called Stars Have Stories, and that continues until the end of June. We're all thinking, of course, we've been thinking for some time, and we're well in production now for a program called Moving to Mars for July around Perseverance departure. And we're thinking of a couple of other things. I, for example, realized that no matter what the situation is in August, we're all going to be running to the hills and possibly taking in the Perseid shower that happens in mid-August. And I thought, well, maybe I should make sure that we have a program that helps people understand what they need to know about shooting stars and meteor showers so that they can enjoy it even more so. These are the sorts of things. And what's the cadence to have programming under these circumstances? Are we all going to be zoomed out and maybe not being interested in online programming, and how to make it relevant? And I'll just say one more thing, and that is I also have had some data that I haven't had a chance to get to. So this will be my opportunity to be able to do some of my own work. And that's exciting.
Yeah, it's definitely good to see discoveries both locally and internationally are still continuing, and that, of course, we can continue to have these conversations together. So, Jean, thanks very much for joining me, and until next month.
Thank you so much, Audrey. This was fun.
Jean Creighton is our astronomy contributor and the director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. You can find all of our past segments with her at WUWM.com. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee area businesses have been struggling to survive. Although in much of the state, businesses are allowed to reopen without any official guidelines, Milwaukee and many of its nearby suburbs have safer-at-home orders limiting business activity. Still, as the pandemic wears on, local businesses are looking to the future, figuring out how to change their business model to fit the needs of their community while maintaining safety. Near Westside Partners has been working with businesses in its neighborhoods to help them figure out the best path forward. Keith Stanley is the executive director of Near Westside Partners, and Kelsey Otero is the co-chair of the organization's Commercial Corridor Working Team. They join Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about their work so far and what's ahead.
As the realities of the Safer at Home order became clear, what were some of your biggest concerns as an organization that works with small businesses?
I would say from the Nearest Side Partners perspective, as a community organization, and we also run the Business Improvement District bid number 10, was just really the survival of our businesses, knowing that many of them would have to shut down. And have an opportunity to listen to them and understand what their concerns were as they navigated through this new uncharted territory with COVID-19.
Yeah. You know, Keith, your organization works with so many different businesses. What are some of the kinds of businesses that you work with on the Near West Side?
We are really have an opportunity, a unique opportunity to work with some of the largest brands in the world, as well as some of the most dynamic and cool local hot new businesses that are ran by families and mom-pa outfits. And so whether it's working for brands like the 5 o'clock Steakhouse that has a 60 plus year history, or working with Daddy's Soul Food or Lisa K Catering, we are able to really to connect on many levels, small, mid-range to large and national brands.
So most businesses, restaurants have been a little different because they've been able to do some takeout, some things during this safer at home order. But many businesses have been shuttered right now. How are they doing? You know, you work with some very big brands and you work with some really small ones.
I would say there's a couple of things, or there's some reactions that I've been able to take note. One, I think most people, most of our businesses that we're starting to hear from are just, they're in uncharted territory and they're trying to just figure out what makes sense as far as for the safety and the wellness of their employees and other patrons, but also what makes sense for as far as the future and reopening. And there's a balance that everyone is playing at this time. You want to make sure that we're safe and we're practicing social distancing, but we also know that the economy needs to get back. And so I think what I take note is that, yes, at the very beginning when things were shuttered and it was unexpected, I think none of our businesses actually furloughed, laid off, and even let go of employees. Some of our businesses stopped production and just closed up. We even had a couple of our gas stations that were looking at boarding up their windows because people weren't buying gas. I think we've gotten beyond that. And I think that a lot of our businesses now see the light at the end of the tunnel. And now they're just trying to figure out what makes sense moving forward. And a lot of that we're working closely with Kelsey on. But some of our businesses, what makes sense when it comes to the restaurant industry and how do we help them with social distancing? We're having conversations with a number of our restaurants to assist them with that process. We're having conversations with other businesses about the safe way to reopen. We've been able to have going on our second webinar, reopening webinar for our businesses in the Near West Side, where we've connected them with state and city resources so they can ask those questions about reopening. And we've assisted our businesses with working closely with Town Bank for the payroll protection program. And Town Bank has been helpful with assisting a number of our businesses apply for that payroll protection program to help them cover some of the costs that has incurred since COVID-19 occurred early March or middle of March.
Well, and so far, how have businesses been evolving the kinds of services they offer and the kinds of things they're doing for their customers, for their community, since this pandemic began?
We're starting to see a lot of our convenience stores really sell fresh produce, which is a good thing for the Near West Side, and offering more variety in their offerings. And our smaller convenience stores and even grocery stores really responding to the market and responding to the need that people don't want to go to the big box stores but want to shop locally, and which is a great trend, and want to shop safely in familiar places and smaller places.
Oh, yeah. I think that's absolutely important. I think, you know, crisis has encouraged some businesses to try new things, and the inequities have become more apparent than ever. And so we're seeing businesses step up in new ways by providing some of the fresh produce. And we've seen consumers step up too by supporting them. And that's been a really nice kind of unexpected silver lining in all of this. The other thing I would add is, I've been surprised at how many people during this time have started to think about starting their own business. And I expected that, you know, people would halt plans, and we're still moving forward with a number of businesses that are planning to open up in the Near West Side and other entrepreneurs that are thinking about what their future of starting their own business means. And that's really encouraging. I think this is a great time for people to be thinking outside of the box and, you know, putting pen to paper when it comes to launching their own business or their own idea. And we've also seen people stepping up, not only just with starting a business, but thinking about how they can impact the community and help during this time. It's brought out the best in a lot of the citizens in our neighborhood.
Kelsey, you've been working with a lot of local restaurants to help support them during this time. What have you been doing? What are some of the things that you've been doing to help support these restaurants?
We've done a lot of outreach to our local businesses to first and foremost see, you know, how their current status is, what some of their needs consist of, and make sure that they're aware of the resources that are available to them as businesses that are currently operating. In addition, we've been able to deploy some specific resources to businesses in the Near West Side through our BID, our Business Improvement District. That's BID number 10. And we've also worked with a number of other local partners, such as LISC Milwaukee, to redeploy some funds to allow restaurants and businesses to pay employees. And then we've also worked with businesses that have been able to think creatively about how this could be an opportunity for them to rethink and reimagine their business and to demonstrate some resiliency and hopefully come out when, you know, we are reopened in a position that's really favorable for them and their organization and our community. We've also done something that I think is particularly fun. We've launched a Made in the Near West Side series, and we've been featuring primarily restaurants, but we have a couple of non-restaurants coming up in the near future. And each of these businesses that have been selected and opted in to participate have put together a demonstration of them cooking one of their more popular items. And they've also offered a take and bake kit. So it allows consumers to not only patron the business and get some of the ingredients and products that they love from that restaurant, but also to take it at home and learn some of the trade secrets of the local business or restaurant. And we hope that this reminds some of our consumers and patrons that these destination businesses exist within the Near West Side, and when we are open again, that it's going to be a great place to come back and to support them.
Yeah, the cooking part is so interesting. It reminds me of those meals that you order in where they give you the box with all the ingredients and the list of how to do it, but instead you get to try something that you might already be familiar with from a local business that you frequent.
Yeah, I think the 5 o'clock steakhouse example and getting instructions on how to cook a steak the 5 o'clock way, not only do you get the instructions, but you can pick up some really high quality meat from them. And a number of people who participated in that particular one noted just what a phenomenal experience it was, that the quality of the products that they received were top-notch, the experience of ordering and getting the product and then of cooking it and preparing it was a really unique experience. And so not only are we bringing a unique experience to the restaurants, but we're bringing a unique experience to the community as well and allowing them to participate in this and help support small businesses from their home. I, for one, have become a better cook during quarantine because of all of this. And so we hope that others within the Near West Side and some of the folks that are visitors to the Near West Side, that this has helped to inspire them to spend a little bit more time in the kitchen as well.
Certainly. I think all of us, for better or worse, have spent a lot of time in the kitchen. I made one of my grandmother's recipes recently, who was a heavy smoker and a ballerina, so she didn't really eat. It's an interesting cake. So as we're looking at, you know, a lot of different businesses reopening, not just restaurants, but as we progress through this pandemic and hopefully the cases get less and less, businesses are looking to open their doors again. What are some of the concerns that you're hearing from the businesses that you work with, and what are you doing to, yes, support them moving forward?
I would say from our end, we see a major issue, I think, with businesses trying to understand what is the community standard for reopening. And what we mean by that, I think, when I listen to some of the businesses, and our, like I said, our first webinar was held 2 weeks ago, Are businesses expecting their employees and their patrons, everyone, to wear a mask? If so, you know, how do we handle it when someone doesn't isn't wearing a mask? Another one is, you know, how are we going to handle lunch? Some of our businesses, many of our businesses fit in the mid-size category, and that being where they have 50 or more employees, and where do those people sit for lunch? You know, how do they practice the social distancing? And so we're trying to get a grip on working with our state and local officials on what a community standard looks like for our businesses so they can implement. We're also working with a graphic designer to help some of our businesses so they have the material they need for their patrons to understand that they are practicing social distancing. So whether it's flyers, floor decals, A-frame boards, so when people come in, they know that they're asking their patrons to either wear a mask or wait in line 6 feet apart, use one-way aisles, things of that nature. And so that's what we're starting to hear. And I think everyone wants to be a part of the solution when it comes to making sure we're slowing the spread and we get through this. At the same time, we know that we have to get back to some sense of normalcy for our businesses.
I think the other thing is that this is such a time of uncertainty, and I think that's the other thing that, you know, is really worrisome to businesses is, you know, once we do reopen, as Keith mentioned, there's still a lot of uncertainty that comes with that. Are people going to come out? Are they going to follow the rules? You know, how is this entire process going to continue to evolve? And I think, you know, without certain, it's really forced a lot of people to become more resilient personally and with their business operations.
Yeah. Well, Keith, Kelsey, thank you so much for speaking with me and for sharing your work.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Keith Stanley is the executive director of Near West Side Partners, and Kelsey Otero is the co-chair of the Commercial Corridor Working Team from the Near West Side Partners. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.